Senate Judiciary Committee, May 20th, 1991, 7 p.m.
Committee of three, the others be, have been properly notified. We left off, we had a couple of bills here that were remaining from the afternoon session. Let's start with the folks who've come down to share their time and have been willing to make arrangement with their time to stay here. And so let's start with 2542 and kind of go on through 42, 43, and 44.
Well, I guess I should probably go get those bills.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Bring them bills. I can go get them. I don't
Do you have anybody who could go get
them? Thank you, Madam Chair. Russ Spencer, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. By way of introduction, we are presenting to you three bills this evening, which the Sheriff's Association put together as their primary legislative package this session dealing with sex offender legislation. These bills were crafted by a task force put together with sheriffs, deputy sheriffs with expertise in investigating sex crimes and sex offenses, deputy district attorneys, and also with some political consultation provided by yours truly. We believe that these are important pieces of legislation which address serious gaps or serious problems that our officers face on a daily basis. A number of them address issues where our officers have a tremendous sense of frustration because they see a flagrant abuse of persons' personal rights without having the ability to charge them under the law.
Great.
With me is Jim McIntyre, who's the Deputy District Attorney for Multnomah County and has a great deal of expertise in prosecuting these types of crimes and was a key member of our task force in drafting this legislation, and he is here to address the specifics. Also in the audience who will come up and testify later are Chief Criminal Deputy Stan Robson from Benton County and Detective Christy Gustafson from Multnomah County, also with a great deal of expertise in these types of crimes. With that, I will turn it over to Jim to discuss the philosophical and practical applications of these bills.
Thanks.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim McIntyre from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. House Bill 2542, which is before the committee, is a revision of the sexual abuse statutes. And what it does is take what was previously a two-degree crime and break it into 3 degrees. Third degree being sexual contact with someone who is incapable of consent for being less than 18 years of age, mentally defective, mentally incapacitated, or physically helpless. Second degree dealing with the fact that someone who has a non-consensual sexual intercourse or deviant sexual intercourse. And then first degree where the victim is less than 14 years of age, and also where someone compels another person or causes a person who's less than 18 years of age to touch or contact the mouth or anus or sex organs of an animal for the purposes of gratification makes that a Class B felony. The purpose of this bill is to get a clearer definition and better sanctions involved for a long time, for people who involve children in sexual contact and pedophilia. As the committee may be aware, a large number of pedophiles often engage their victims in actual just purely sexual contact, and that sexual contact can involve victims in different age ranges. Okay. 2542 is intended to hopefully give better definition to the different types of sexual activities and deal more appropriately with sanctions for that type of contact.
So that you have raised
The final outcome is that if there is non-consenting sexual contact between someone who's 14 to 18 years of age, it's going to be a Class A misdemeanor. If there are if there is sexual intercourse, deviant sexual intercourse, with someone against their consent, it will be a Class C felony. If you are engaged, if a defendant engages in sexual contact with a victim who is less than 14 years of age, what we're doing is raising the statutory age limit. If the victim is less than 14, then it will be a Class B felony. Additionally, if you cause or allow a person less than 18 years of age, or if by forcible compulsion you compel someone to have sexual contact with an animal, it will be also be a Class B felony, which will raise it to what's a Category 9 offense under the sentencing guidelines.
Okay. Further, other questions? Ingrid? Is there other way to? Is there another way to do this rather than just specify? Is this one that rather than just specify specifically the class, the Category 9? Is there another way to do that without just pulling a category out of the?
Well, what happens under the current statutory scheme? Sexual abuse in the first degree is a Category 8 offense, which is sort of in line with what the administrative rules were and the designation of the sentencing guidelines of a Category 8 offense. The difficulty is...
So could we assume that it would be a 9 if you raised it just to a Class B?
Can you assume it would be a 9 under the guidelines designation if you raise it to a Class B? Possibly. It depends on what the Sentencing Guidelines Commission were to determine under the administrative rules finding. The reason that we have in there the Section 4, which is page 2, lines 11 and 12, is to make it clear that the legislature would find that this type of an offense is of the type of severity we want to address with a presumptive penitentiary sentence, which is the really significant difference, because the significant difference is that as a Category 8 offense, if the offender has no prior conviction or only minor misdemeanor convictions, it would be in a grid block that would allow for what's called optional probation, so that the judge would have the discretion to give a non-appealable straight sentence of probation. This way, the presumptive sentence would be penitentiary. If there were certain or the proper mitigating factors that would allow for a departure, which would require a full evidentiary hearing, then the court could, of course, always depart. But the presumption would be penitentiary when there's sexual contact with a minor, or certainly when there's someone subjected to forcible compulsion, or they require a minor to have sexual contact with
anyone. We have basically tried to stay away, at least for now, from just picking indiscriminate grid blocks as a legislature, because oftentimes, it doesn't fit in. Then we mix up the school. The graduation, the whole criminal history side of things, in terms of their schematics, and I was just trying to figure if there's a way around. Actually, maybe we can say we want to say that it should be presumptive prison time, rather than specifically quoting a grid block.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe with this offense and the serious nature of this offense that by designating a Category 9 offense, you are doing what should be done, which is that the legislature should make a statement that this type of contact is deserving of a penitentiary sentence.
Well, I think we could say that maybe without directing explicitly to that. I just want to figure out a better way to get there, maybe.
Madam Chair, we can entertain with legislative counsel perhaps some alteration to page 2, lines 11 and 12 relative to that designation.
I'm not arguing with that it ought not to be in a...
I understand.
Need to figure out how to get there without picking it.
Perhaps if the wording were...
we'll work it out between now and work session.
Correct.
I just wanted to raise it with you to get you thinking about
Madam Chair, if I just might add, at least earlier today, I'm not sure if he's here, Tom Dixon from the Oregon State Police had an amendment they wish to offer. I'm not sure if they're here this evening or not. Just want to state for the record that we have no problem with their proposed amendment.
Okay. Great.
Could I ask one question? Looking at Section 3 of the bill, which creates the new first-degree crime of sexual abuse, I noticed there's no age defense, so that if a 16-year-old prosecuted as an adult has sexual contact with a 14-year-old, it's a Class C felony. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Committee Counsel, the... The bill as written would not provide for a statutory defense under the facts that you've just given to me.
And I noticed that in Section 1, there is such a defense for sex abuse in the third degree.
Madam Chair, Committee Counsel, that's correct because it's our intent to opt for the protection of minors less than 14 years of age at all costs, for lack of any better way of saying it. And then we have that cutoff. And we're trying to balance, obviously, some competing interest here, but we're trying to balance with the repetitive conduct that we've had to deal with sexual contact with minors less than 14, versus what could be the other side of the spectrum, which what you're speaking of, well, to the 16-year-olds.
Madam Chair, just for the record, I would indicate that the definition of sexual contact, which is in ORS 163.305(6), basically means any touching of the sexual or intimate parts of another person. So it's not intercourse or anything of that nature. It can be, but it need not be.
Madam Chair, Ms. Swenson, if this may be another point, again, if this becomes a sticking point for the bill, our clear intent is to focus on pedophilia and to focus on forcible pedophiles, even if they're juvenile forcible pedophiles. But our clear intent is to focus on pedophilia and not to necessarily encompass the difficult age range between 12 and 18 years of age. If there's a way that we could perhaps work with counsel to find to adopt Section 3 into the other statutory allowed defenses, I think that we could work with committee counsel on that to make sure that that's fixed.
Thanks. We appreciate it. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's figure out our, what else here? Detective Gustafson and Stan Robson. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I'm Christy Gustafson. I'm a detective with Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. I've been with Multnomah County Sheriff's for over 10 years. I'm currently assigned to working the Sex Crimes Division of the department. I'd like to tell you about a couple of different cases that I have worked or been involved with or have knowledge of that are appropriate to this bill. In the first case, I personally investigated a case where a 13-year-old girl was visiting her father. This was a non-custodial parent. Her parents had divorced. This girl was 13, 2 days after actually her 13th birthday. When she was 6 years old, she had been sexually abused by her father, but that situation was not handled criminally. The case that I was involved in investigating, the victim was 13. She was visiting her father, and he sexually abused her shortly after she went to visit him. During the investigation, the victim admitted that she had sexual intercourse with her father when she was six. That was not prosecuted because the statute of limitations had expired. Reviewing that, though, the case that I investigated was actually only able to be prosecuted as a misdemeanor because it was a sex abuse too because of her age. The frustrating thing also in that case was that the father was currently married to a woman who had two adolescent children from a previous marriage. Also part of that statute involves sex with animals, forcibly having children have sex with animals. I'd like to tell you about a case in Washington County where detectives investigated a case in which a 9-year-old boy forced his younger brothers to engage in oral sodomy with him. During the course of their investigation, the detectives learned that the boy was also forcing his two younger brothers, ages 4 and 2, to perform fellatio on the family dog, which under the current law is not a crime. That's why I believe that it's important that this bill becomes law.
What would you do with a 9-year-old?
I think, you know, that was an example. That was an actual case history. With a 9-year-old, I think that would be up to the district attorney whether they would want to prosecute something like that. I think as somebody gets older, this could have easily been an 18-year-old or a 21-year-old or an adult.
I understand that. I'm asking you a direct question. What do you?
But I personally would do on something like that. I think actually what would happen on a case like that, that child, by possibly eventually prosecuting them, if that became law, as a sex abuse, different counts, getting him into the system and getting him some help for that boy. That's ultimately what I would want to see for that boy. He's 9 years old, but as I say, you could turn that around and make that child...
Have you thought about investigating the parents to find out how...
Certainly on a case like that is where did that behavior come from? You know, the problem, again, though, is that that 9-year-old does not tell me where that behavior came from. I can ask him about it. I can certainly investigate it. But if I can't find out, I don't have anything. I can't do anything.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Stan.
I'm Stan Robson. I'm Chief Criminal Deputy for Benton County Sheriff's Department. I've been in law enforcement just over 20 years, and 14 of those years I was an investigator for mostly crimes against persons and focusing mostly on child abuse and sexual exploitation of children. And I really strongly believe in this bill in that I think that we're not looking at the crime seriously enough. And the most recent case in the farm home case down in Corvallis where Hank DePort was criminally prosecuted for multiple cases of crimes against boys, we found that many cases it was we couldn't get anything more than a misdemeanor complaint because of the age of the kids involved. We're looking at under 12 to make it a felony, where actually the type of situation that they were in with the intimidation and his administrative capacity was so strong that it certainly necessitates more stronger action than a misdemeanor complaint. That's why we're asking for the age change to be under 14 instead of under 12. I also worked cases where animals were used in the sexual abuse of children, in that I had a 16-year-old boy who forced his 3-year-old nephew to orally fellatiate the family dog. And I had no crime until I got him to confess that he also participated in other sexual abuse. And in these cases, we used to have the bestiality statute, and we no longer do, where I think we need that. And it isn't even only in these cases, but we're finding more and more cases of occult abuse where we are finding animals being used in ritualistic sexual abuse of children. And this is more and more common every day, and I think we need this to deal with those particular cases.
Great. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. Lee Erickson. We have Lloyd Smith with you, or is it just you tonight? Why don't you come on up?
Madam Chair, Lloyd is here.
Okay. If you have comments to make, that'd be great.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lee Erickson, Director of Identification Services, Oregon State Police. I'm appearing before you today in support of House Bill 2542. I'm also representing the Oregon Law Enforcement Legislative Committee, which is composed of various law enforcement organizations in the state. Department of State Police is in strong support of House Bill 2542, sponsored by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We have an extensive involvement in the investigation of sexual assaults against children, and we believe this bill will assist in aligning the punishment with the true nature of the offense. We are submitting, however, today an amendment to the bill that deals with the Oregon homicide file. The 1985 legislature enacted the first law in the nation to require that all criminal homicides be reported to a central repository at the state level. The purpose of this mandatory reporting was to assist in establishing linkages between serial homicides. This is a result of our experience with murders the likes of Ted Bundy, Randy Kraft, Jerome Brudos, William Scott Smith, and a host of others. The 1985 Oregon law placed the responsibility of the compilation and maintenance of the file with the law enforcement data system. This proposed amendment to the existing statute merely transfers the responsibility of the collection and maintenance of the file. This would allow the state police to analyze and coordinate the information for the entire justice system. We are currently assisting local law enforcement through crime laboratories, identification services by latent print analysis, APHIS, document examination, the unidentified dead file, the missing children clearinghouse, major crime teams, and interagency narcotics teams. We also have been working closely with the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the development of their violent offender criminal apprehension program, known as VICAP. The Department of State Police has been continuing to refine its investigative focus on violent crime and the assistance to local law enforcement. We are not asking for any additional manpower or monies to assume this responsibility from the law enforcement data system. This process is merely part of our commitment in focusing state resources on interjurisdictional violent crime. We believe that this is in complete alignment in using state resources to address statewide and interstate problems. The Oregon State Sheriff's Association, sponsor of this bill, is in favor of this amendment.
Thank you. Are there
questions?
Thank you. Lloyd?
Madam Chair, this we fully support this. We actually started this process going. We at LADS really haven't been able to do justice to the intent of this bill. We think the state police would be able to do a much better job because they are already involved in the investigation of virtually all homicides in the state. The LADS Advisory Committee has approved this proposal. We have done a survey of all the law enforcement agencies in the state and have received no negative response. So we think it's a good move. It will put it where it belongs and get a better job done.
Thank you. Any questions of Lloyd? Thanks. We'll get the amendment to Ingrid for work session. Thanks very much. Let's move to House Bill 2543. Ross, Jim McIntyre. Next up, we'll have Elise Clausen and Stan Robeson again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Russ Spencer for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I want to say how nice it is to be back before this committee again. I will, in the interest of expediency, defer directly to Deputy District Attorney McIntyre on this issue. Thank you.
Jim McIntyre from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I neglected to point out that this was, again, a non-consensual trip to Salem. The reason for House Bill 2543 is, as I've been here all day, and I listened very interestingly to Mr. Fotz's comment on the registration of offenders under this bill, under another bill that was before the committee today. The purpose of House Bill 2543 is to extend probation and post-prison supervision for persons convicted of sex offenders. And it is intended to address the fact that all of the treatment providers that I have encountered in handling these types of offenses that have credibility with not only with prosecutors, but with the courts and with the defense bar and within their own experts within their field, maintain that even at best, their treatment programs work only under circumstances where there is continued monitoring and treatment, or at least the possibility for intervention and treatment when situational circumstances develop that may cause a person to reoffend. At worst, they never work. And that someone who is a pedophile and a sexual offender under a lot of these statutes will, in all probability reoffend. House Bill 2543 is intended to place an offender in a position where if they are placed on probation, it shall be for at least a period of 5 years minimum, and that also that if they hit post-prison supervision, they can be held on that type of supervision for the maximum determinate sentence for which they're of the crime for which they were convicted of. It's the intent of this bill to allow exactly what we want, and that is long-term monitoring and supervision of convicted sex offenders and pedophiles within the state of Oregon. It is a bill that would be triggered after conviction, after either a jury trial or court trial, or someone has entered a plea. It will be after they've either served their term of incarceration or after they've been given the alternatives of probation. It's clearly a public safety issue. It also dovetails quite nicely with whatever the legislature may do as to registration of these offenders. And that's the reason for House Bill 2543.
I might just add, currently, the maximum we can keep these people under supervision is 3 years. And our studies show almost unerringly that while these gentlemen, predominantly gentlemen, that's a loose term, are under intense supervision, they do not reoffend. When they're on the polygraph, when they're subject to urinalysis, when they're subject to intensive supervision, they do not reoffend. We also find almost unerringly that when they get off of supervision, they do reoffend. We have multiple reoffenders, and I'll leave it to Deputy Robson to categorize
that. Yeah, I would also, we don't need a lot of testimony in these bills. Extensively, the committee has had a day of treatment people come in and give us a whole series of what the options were and what the kinds of offenders' behavior is, and so we've had fairly in-depth in this committee.
Madam Chair, good bill should pass.
I want to let you know that. Thanks.
Madam Chair, one question.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
Is there any provision anywhere for a hearing to cut back the post-prison supervision if they can demonstrate that they have rehabilitated themselves?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, initially you have me at a loss, but I would have to go back to the administrative rules within the Guidelines Commission on post-prison supervision. My first response would be no, because there would be a judicial order that would issue relative to the length of post-prison supervision. I know that there are certainly procedures in place where someone could come back and petition a court, that is the sentencing court, and present to the sentencing court whatever full compliance there was or had been, and the sentencing courts would have the discretion in an adversarial hearing, which is fair because that would represent both the victim and the defendant, to determine whether or not that amount of post-prison supervision or whatever the level of supervision was should be changed or terminated. But within the statute itself, no. But there is already some mechanisms in place as to how the judiciary would work in that type of a hearing.
It seems to me that it, for at least some people, lifetime or supervision for 30 years or 20 years is going to be a waste of money after a while. Why just keep throwing that money down the drain supervising somebody who doesn't need it?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, if response to that comment and question, I would assume that there would still be administrative rules in place and hopefully that some discretion as far as levels of supervision to come into compliance with what the court orders were. And certainly there are already provided for statutory procedures and administrative procedures and judicial procedures for review of any sentence where someone is under that type of probation supervision or parole board supervision.
It is part of the original sentence, so it's not anything that you can adjust along the way.
Without...
It is
overview.
Not something you can
it's
adjust.
Not something you can adjust along the way.
I wonder if we shouldn't provide a vehicle for that. So that
well,
get off
in the sentencing scheme, one would have to look at that. Senator Hill.
Yes, I was looking at the fiscal impact. the resources, is this included in the governor's budget? I mean, are the resources available to do this?
We have a lease clause coming up.
Oh, okay, because I guess the point is that we pass bills just like what we used to do with prison sentences, and then we don't have any space, and then we feel good that we feel we've passed the laws, and I mean, I guess I just want to be sure that we're accomplishing something.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, frankly, I understand that there has been a rather severe fiscal impact that has been attached to this bill. And my only statement can be, if that is true in its worst scenario, it's worth paying for dollar for dollar. Because of the times we have looked at the newspaper and seen the recidivist impact of sexual offenders on the victims. And so if that is true, then it needs to be prioritized. And Mr. Shepard, Mr. Spencer actually has a better response to that.
My only comment on that, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, would be, my understanding is that the fiscal impact is predicated upon the worst possible scenario. Our findings, and Chief Deputy Robson will bear this out through community corrections, are that a number of the category of criminal we're dealing with here, the pedophile and so forth, are quite capable of paying their own supervision and their own treatment costs. And we would, I think we're planning to try to come up with some evidence that will show you that the fiscal impact will be somewhat less than, significantly less than what you're looking at on the fiscal impact statement before you.
Let me ask a Mayor,
yeah.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Do at the national level. Now, the last thing I want to talk about, and then I'll quit, is the prevention-oriented strategies. I'm not prepared to say that our treatment programs here should be eliminated wholesale at all, but we do have to face the fact that there's going to be limited dollars to go around. And so what I'm saying is that we should look at programs like the Utah Parent-Child Safety Program. Utah has a prevention education program that I think is outstanding. It's a four-phase program. It starts with the parent-teacher orientation in the school system. They involve the parents right from the start. They then go to the McGruff Science Program, which are the Safe Homes project. Then follows classroom instruction. That's the third phase. And the fourth phase is maintenance of the program. There are programs of this type going on in Oregon, but they're uncertain and they're not overall coordinated. In Washington, where the state pays 75% of the cost of education, the child safety education in the schools is all directed from the state superintendent of public instruction office. That's in charge of a Dr. Ruth Harms. Her title, Supervisor, Child Abuse Prevention Education. So I'm saying then that if we go into this program, I believe that we should give serious thought to child safety education at the state level and be under the supervision of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, because I believe you're going to get a bigger bang for your buck out of child safety education than you were perhaps out of clinical treatment, just based on the lack of proof and support for that thing. In Japan, for instance, how do they meet this problem? Students assemble in their neighborhoods on their way to school, and they come to school in a group under the supervision of a senior student, an older student, and a ditto going back. They have lots of latchkey kids in Japan, too, but this is bringing the children themselves into the act, to teach them to look out for each other. These are things that I think we're going to have to look at more and more with Measure 5. And that's all I'm going to say, and thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you very much for coming. It's always good to see you, Judge.
Okay.
Thanks. Senator Shoemaker.
Will those studies that you referred to, Judge Thornton, will they be part, will we have those within the committee to take a look at if you want to?
As of right now, the only thing you have is the paper that I wrote for the Crime Analysis Center, which is called Controlling Dangerous Sex Offenders, Are We on the Right Track? I don't have copies to give you of these other studies, but I can work with the committee counsel and provide them to you. I'm talking about the Vermont program. Here's the paper on the Vermont program. The Atascadero program is still in the planning stage. The Washington program I have here I'll make that available.
And then thank you. We'll get it.
All right. Will do.
Thank you very much. Okay. Let's move to House Bill 2200. Elise Claussen and Jeff Van Falkenberg. We can move quickly through a number of bills, and then we have enough folks signed up on one last bill.
What number?
2200.
Are we into our evening agenda now?
Into the evening agenda.
Okay.
2200. There we go.
On the record, my name is Elise Claussen, Assistant Director of the Department of Corrections. The subject of this bill is the authorization of the Department of Corrections to dispose of property seized during search or arrest of suspected parole or post-prison supervision violators. At the present time, the Department of Corrections staff seized property that is alleged to be in violation of the law or conditions of supervision. We are currently, through statute, provided the ability through the courts to authorize disposition of property seized from probationers. However, similar statutory authority does not exist for the disposition of property by the court or the parole board of the Department of Corrections with respect to parole or post-prison supervision cases. So essentially, the problem that we have right now is that when we are seizing property that is not does not end up being used for adjudication for a new crime, but is rather used for a parole revocation case, then we have that property and have no method to dispose of it. It's dangerous to continue to store it. It poses a storage problem, and we need to have some authority, express authority in the statute to be able to dispose of this kind of property. The property is usually things like drugs, drug paraphernalia, sometimes weapons. Those are the primary things that we seize in the process of a search or an arrest.
Okay, thank you. Jeff?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm with the Department of Justice. I'm here to explain the legal effect of House Bill 2200. I drafted this bill primarily based on the existing arrest and seizure statutes in Chapter 133 with very little change. It's just adapted to the circumstances of parole and post-prison supervision. It provides due process for claims by innocent third parties who will receive notice and opportunity for hearing upon petition to the Department of Corrections. It provides that the Department of Corrections, upon a disputed claim, could hold a hearing or leave the participants to a process where the individual could seek civil process in the courts to seek determination and disposition. Other than that, there's processes which govern most situations. Are there any specific questions I can answer?
Other questions for Jeff?
One of, I'm sure your pleasure.
Make you're still reading.
Oh. Are there is there legislation like this in other states?
I don't know the answer to that, Senator Shoemaker.
Seems pretty sensible. Wonder why we haven't done it already.
Okay. I think we're ready.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, then we move House Bill 2200 and gross to the floor to the Patrick Foundation.
Thank you. There's further discussion of Senator Hill's motion to pass House Bill 2200 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Call the roll, please.
Okay. Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. 2196, Elise, here.
For the record, my name is Elise Claussen, Assistant Director of the Department of Corrections. We support House Bill 2196. Essentially, House Bill 2196 enables it's a housekeeping measure, and it enables the department to carry out the intent of the original legislation, which was to send released parolees to the county where they resided when they were committed to prison. The current statute gives a whole list of things the for us to determine residency, and essentially we're asking for two changes. One is that we use all of the information available to determine where the parolee lived and what their residence was prior to being institutionalized, and that we also add department records. The problem is that the driver's license is the first thing on the list, and so many of these people do not keep up accurate driver's licenses or addresses on those that we end up sending parolees back to places where they haven't been for years, and it was not a residence for them. So essentially, we just want to fix that. We certainly want to continue the intent of the law. We believe it's been a good law and has been helpful to us.
Questions for Elise?
Move the bill.
Okay, Senator Shoemaker has moved House Bill 2196 to the floor with a Duke Pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, 2203, Mr. Foote.
Good evening, Madam Chair. Members of Committee. For the record, my name is John Foote. I'm the Inspector General for the Department of Corrections. I'll be very brief. This bill is addressing a loophole I found when I came to Salem, when I talked to the DAs around the state about how they handle cases from the institutions. In essence, there's a case which I've attached, if you wish to read it, which is the case that DA's officers relied upon to say that they couldn't prosecute small amounts of marijuana, because the statute provides that every piece of contraband must be proven in court to be dangerous. And that meant that DA's office had to prove that marijuana was a dangerous drug medically, which turned small trials into major production. And the DA's office has backed away from doing it. All this statute does is make it per se a crime, the same level it is anyway, a C felony, for an inmate to have any controlled substance, including small amounts of marijuana, drug paraphernalia, and money. Those are all things that inmates use to corrupt each other and staff, and they just cause nothing but trouble. They're illegal. They can't have them in this prison anyway. And it retains the last portion, which was what the statute was originally, which is anything else that's dangerous. It just specifically parcels out three things that nobody has to prove is dangerous. If an inmate has it, it's a C felony. That's all the statute's designed to do, is just catch that loophole. It's not elevating anything or changing anything else.
Okay, are there questions?
One question, Madam Chair. Why do we still have the catch-all sub D depend upon the contraband being a danger to somebody else? Why not simply have it anything else which they're not entitled to have?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, we did that because as I talked to people around the state in the institutions, I found that their main concern with these items and things that could be dangerous. And that seemed to address their concerns. I didn't see a pressing need to make it anything, because they have all sorts of things that rules don't allow them to have that we wouldn't want to have in a criminal court. You'd bog the courts down. Best left for an administrative sanction.
Okay, thank you. Good answer.
Okay, Ingrid.
Madam Chair, if I may, Mr. Foote, one question. When it refers to in sub C at line 9 on page 1 of the bill to money possessed or obtained by an inmate, how is that to be distinguished from funds in an inmate's account legitimately in those accounts? Because if an inmate obtains money and it goes into his account, wouldn't that technically be a violation the way this is phrased?
I suppose that in a narrow reading or a broad reading it might be, Madam Chair, Counsel. That is certainly not the intent. The language was added, obtained or possessed by an inmate in the house in concerns for staff who might have money. And we certainly didn't want to cause that.
They could, about, yeah. You're looking about...
we
got to see what that means.
How about using the word cash instead of using the word money? I was wondering the same thing myself and decided not to pursue it. But I think cash means spending money, and money is anything, you know, be a checking account, things of that sort.
Yeah, that, I think we might want to take a look at that and make sure that we aren't
wrapping in other Social Security, you know, other sort of entitlements, whatever they happen to be, possessed or obtained. The word obtained, I guess, is the one. Possessed is not, I mean, that means physically have in their possession in their cell, which you certainly don't want them to. That's a different matter than obtained by an inmate and obtained yeah. in their legitimate account.
Madam Chair, possessed under the law actually could, I think counsel was alluding to this, could include constructive possession of their trust account. I assume that's what counsel was talking about, her concern. And I see that problem. I wouldn't want to eliminate the possibility, and this happens all the time, inmates hold things for each other. Sometimes they're forced to do it. Sometimes they're in collusion.
Yeah. Well, I think we might be able to just work a little bit on this and get
that'd be fine. I have no problem with that.
Make sure it doesn't overreach. Okay, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll give Ingrid a little chore on that one and see if they can come up with something that narrows it or makes it specific. Okay, then let's move to Hospital 2604. Elise is here.
Cool.
Yes.
The ACLU.
Yep. Yes. You're coming here in favor. The whole get whole garage is here.
Such a steam.
I'm not sure I belong up here at this point.
No, I'm not sure you do either.
You waited all day for this to get squeezed between these two, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, my name is Vern Fotz. I chair the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and I don't know whether I want to go first or not.
You signed up last, but that's okay.
Oh, I'll let Mr. Fedanke go.
No.
Well, I'm somewhat responsible for this bill, so I'll start out. Yeah. 2604 does a number of things for us, and it comes about in part because of Ballot Measure 5 and because of the changes that are taking place in the Board of Parole and its function. And very briefly, what it does is this. It allows us to enter into agreements with the local supervisory authority for the use of intermediate sanctions at the local level in a way that we now cannot do. It also allows us, and I'm now over on page 2 of the bill, to delegate certain authority in whole or in part to the designated representative, as will be provided by rule. And what that means is that we can enter into an agreement, designate a supervisory authority to level certain kinds of sanctions that can now be implemented only by the Board of Parole after a fairly lengthy set of procedures are implemented. Over on page 3, let's go over to page 4, where it speaks to the ability to grant to the local authority the right to cite to hearings certain offenders under circumstances defined by rule. Not now possible, as far as we are concerned. And then finally, we have an item here, and I think this may be what Mr. Fedanke is interested in, and it is this. It's on page 3, section 3, subparagraph 2. When a person released on parole or post-prison supervision is convicted of a crime and sentenced to a term of imprisonment at any institution of the Department of Corrections or its counterpart under the laws of the United States or any other state, such conviction and sentence shall automatically terminate the person's parole or post-prison supervision as of the date of the sentence order. Basically, what that means is that if you commit a crime and you come down to a Department of Corrections facility to serve time, there will not be what we call a Morrissey hearing, a due process hearing around the revocation issue. It's an automatic revocation of your parole. You're already inside. Your parole is then revoked, and you're sentenced to serve as part of that sanction for the parole revocation, a period of time that would be served concurrently with the sentence imposed by the court. By rule, that is now 90 days. That's a quick summation of House Bill 2604, and I'll be glad to become more detailed if that's
The question of Vern before we get into anything else for now.
Well, let me ask, Vern, are these things waived now as a matter of course, or are they performed routinely, or why are we doing this?
Well, the Morrissey hearing at the time of revocation after conviction, no, we, we're required to carry out a hearing on the revocation issue. That is, there's been a violation of the conditions of parole, you've committed a new crime. A hearing is required. It's held. It's, or it may be waived, but something happens, and it comes before the board. We review the report of the hearings officer and make a decision. And what we would do here with this bill is to negate the necessity of that whole series of events. It could become an administrative procedure that just is automatic. If you commit a crime and you're sentenced, then there is, with that, a revocation of your parole.
Okay, Madam Chair, just a brief follow-up. Somebody's going to have to shuffle some paper or verify something. I guess it's just a difference whether it's a clerk or it's going to a hearings officer.
Well, I think that Senator Springer, Madam Chair, that would be not done by the clerical staff in the Office of the Board of Parole.
Okay, I mean, I assume these hearings are pretty much a pro forma matter, although not maybe they do establish that a revocation is appropriate. You tell me. I mean,
in this, Senator Springer, in this instance, where there is a conviction for a crime, it's a pro forma matter. But it takes time, and there's a procedure that has to be followed. And all we're saying is, in these cases, that can be set aside. I mean, it's clear that the violation has occurred. There's no question about that, because there's a new conviction.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Vern, suppose there's a problem after you've delegated this responsibility to the local jurisdiction. What's who's responsible?
Well, Senator Hill, members of the committee, we're in the process of trying to work this whole thing out now. That is, to develop the procedures and to work with the Department of Corrections to establish this. We would do this by in the form of a written, clear agreement with the local supervisory authority or with the Department of Corrections. Ultimately, I assume the board is responsible. It all comes back to us.
Thank you.
Go ahead. Okay. Senator Hill, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Elise Klaus, Assistant Director of the Department of Corrections. Department of Corrections support House Bill 2604. This bill will allow the department and community corrections to use available community resources for supervision of offenders on parole and post-prison supervision. At the present time, there are very limited resources which are devoted to this particular group of offenders. However, this would at least allow us the flexibility to use the resources that do exist and have a continuum of sanctions in the community, such things as house arrest, electronic surveillance, and community services. We would use these prior to returning the offender to the institution if that's appropriate. And the institution is clearly the most costly sanction. This, by the way, is very common practice among probation offenders in the system today. It has not been allowed either by statute or by policy for parolees. We believe there are a number of instances where we could avoid the violation of conditions and or deal with violations of conditions that are less serious than new crime and other kinds of things through the use of intermediate sanctions. And this bill would allow us the ability to do that. So we feel that it's a cost effective, that it's also a public safety issue, and that we support the bill.
Any questions? And so the resources are available out in the...
Senator Hill, the resources are very limited. I mean, there are very limited resources that are devoted to parolees and post-prison supervision offenders, and the reason has been because, one of the reasons at least, is because we've not been able to provide intermediate sanctions and services like this to that group, either by statute or by policy. So there aren't very many resources there, but it would allow us to begin that process of using what limited resources there are and hopefully build on that over time.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Dave?
Thank you, Chair. For the record, David Fedanke, ACLU of Oregon. The ACLU does not have a problem with Section 3 of the bill, nor with Section 1. But I wanted to raise a concern about something that isn't in the bill that we think should be. The current statute is between parole, revocation hearings, and hearings related to violations of post-prison supervision is a hodgepodge. The post-prison supervision hearings are sort of cross-referenced back to the old parole hearing process. But the statute which makes that cross-reference, which is ORS 144.108, applies only to recommitment to prison facilities. If this bill is approved, there will be other types of deprivations of liberty on the part of the person on post-prison supervision, deprivations that we believe should be there as options. But we also believe that if those types of sanctions are going to be imposed, there should be a Morrissey hearing. And I believe that that's probably the current practice of the department, but the statute is silent on that issue, and I think it would be relatively easy to insert that. The only other issue that we wanted to bring up was the, to a certain extent, this is dealt with in the bill as new language and also as old language. There's language in the statute that talks about waivers by the defendant of their hearing, their right to a hearing. And we would like to clarify that those waivers must be knowing waivers. And the two places that at least I've spotted where that shows up would be on line 26 on page 1. A waiver by the defendant of any preliminary hearing shall also constitute a waiver of probable cause hearing by the board. Again, I think existing practice is that waiver be a knowing waiver, but we would like to have the committee insert the word knowing in between the words a waiver on line 26 on page 1. And on page 3, regarding the right to file exceptions in written arguments, on line 29, I believe adding the word knowingly after arguments would make that clear.
Madam Chair? I seem to recall something, one of these homilies, I guess you pick up in the practice of law, that a waiver is a conscious relinquishment of a known right. If that is the definition of waiver, then do we need to be redundant and say knowing waiver? And if we are, by adding it to this waiver, are we suggesting that other places where waiver is used, knowing it might not be an element?
Senator Shoemaker, I don't know the answer to that question. Frankly, I was passing on a comment from one of our cooperating attorneys, and I'm not familiar with any general definition there might be. It may not be a problem.
Okay, well, we're
having
to check it out. Anything else?
That's it.
Vern?
I have no comment, unless you have a question of me, Senator.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, have Ingrid check out a couple of those items. More work for Ingrid. Fortunately, we're about running out. We have two bills here that we haven't, we don't have witnesses signed up on, but let's have Lieutenant Rader come up from the State Police and House Bill 2139 and House Bill 2384. They both deal with false information, giving false information to police officers.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lieutenant Rader of the State Police Patrol Division, speaking to House Bill 2384. This would create the offense of giving false information about liability insurance to a police officer if a person knowingly gives that false information. It makes that offense a Class B misdemeanor, which means that a police officer could, in that case, then arrest. There are times, and I see that this was presented by Lake Oswego at the request of Lake Oswego Police Department, particularly in communities, city police, where you're dealing with the same people continually, and they are giving you false information. And it just puts a stop to that.
Okay. Any questions about that? Thank you. Yeah. Next.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Larry Kraft, Fish and Wildlife Division, Oregon State Police. House Bill 2139 would establish a Class A misdemeanor. The offense of giving a false information to an officer, the person knowingly uses or gives a false name, address, or date of birth to any police officer for the purpose of the officer's issuing a citation under the authority of ORS 153705 to 153765. Currently, the crime of providing false information to an officer only applies to criminal and traffic-related offenses. Passage of this measure would extend this provision to wildlife, commercial fishery laws, and violations of Oregon State Marine Board law. Oregon State Police is in support of this measure.
Okay, any questions?
Chair, I had a question regarding 2384 and all.
Okay.
I went by so fast. On traffic infractions, the police officer's got a, he can plug right into the central computer, can't he, from his vehicle normally?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, yes.
And on that central computer, don't they maintain fairly current liability insurance information?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, they contain no information regarding liability insurance. It is voluntarily or put on by the owner of the car on the back of the registration. And there's, I believe DMV checks about 1% by statute. They're required to check every biennium to see if people are, what percentage of people actually have the insurance they're claiming. But that information is not available to us anywhere.
Hmm. Okay, I just assumed when we gave that information that it found its way onto the database somehow or other. Doesn't
no,
do it, huh?
No, sir.
All right, that answers that question. Thank you.
Okay. 2139, false information to foresee. I tend to say the crowd isn't terribly enthusiastic, are they?
Well, I don't know.
It's hard to get enthusiastic this time of night.
Okay, well, we can come back.
Yeah.